Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking with Nelson Lichtenstein, history professor at UC Santa Barbara, on his book, co-authored with Judith Stein, A Fabulous Failure, The Clinton Presidency and the Transformation of American Capitalism. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. I've only been to one presidential inauguration. I worked on the national staff of the McGovern campaign in 1972, but of course there was no McGovern inauguration. In the early 90s, I was still in the entertainment industry and active in causes and politics, and I was involved in the earliest days of a nonprofit called Education First. Doing some research, looking for innovative programs, I'd been talking with the Department of Education in Arkansas. They were doing some interesting things, and we were staging a luncheon. For our speaker, I suggested their young governor, who seemed to be making education his calling card. Well, Bill Clinton went over very, very well at that luncheon. And a few months later, he was back in LA raising money for a presidential run. I recall at one event in someone's yard, he introduced Hillary as some version of his better half. I don't recall whether she was the real brains of the outfit or the one who really should be running, something like that. Bill Clinton is a little over a year older than I am. I grew up in Florida, he in Arkansas. Our cultural and political experiences growing up were similar, certainly in terms of timing. We both attended Ivy League universities. We were in college at the same time. He was the first president of my generation. My first day as a freshman at Harvard in 1965, as I prepared to climb the stairs to my dorm room for the first time, I was greeted by the guys who lived on the first floor of my entry. One of them was Tommy Lee Jones. Another was Al Gore. Al and I were dorm mates for 3 years, more than acquaintances, less than close friends. To say that I identified with Clinton and Gore more than any other presidential ticket before or since would be an understatement. I knew they were more mainstream than I was, but it was like we were finally in charge. I was excited and hopeful. I anticipated big things. And that inauguration felt like it was about more than a new administration. It felt like we had returned from 12 years in the desert of Reaganism, and America was ready to move in another direction. America loves charismatic optimists, FDR, Kennedy, Reagan, Clinton, Obama. They will sometimes elect others, but it doesn't really make them happy. In fact, FDR, Reagan, and Clinton replaced less charismatically optimistic incumbents after one term. It turns out Americans also assassinate them. JFK, RFK, MLK. So when the Democrats field and elect one, they have to make the most of it. I certainly feel Obama fell short, if only by not seizing the opportunity of the crash to hold the banks and Wall Street accountable and shift the balance of wealth and power at least a bit in favor of the working and middle classes, millions of whom would go MAGA a few years later. But that is another conversation for another show. Off the top of my head, when I think of Clinton's presidency, I think of four headlines: raising taxes to counter the deficits of the Reagan-Bush years, thereby turning over Congress to Newt Gingrich. That one he had to do. Failure to pass the health care bill. 3, passage of policies like NAFTA, media deregulation, welfare reform, and the famous, the era of big government is over. And 4, hugely irresponsible and indulgent sex with an intern. If Reagan and Thatcher brought us neoliberalism, Clinton and Blair were their smiling protégés. Among many, neoliberal has become an epithet, a word spat out in the mix of anger and disgust, so basically wrong in its conception of the world and of society and of humanity. And that conception is that the market matters most, and in it lie the only solutions to our problems. The market, unfettered, or more accurately, writing its own rules, cannot respond effectively to the most critical challenges we face. Crises that have either grown out of the distortion of our economy and our politics or are unsolvable because of them. Inequality, climate change, an unhealthy relationship with the rest of nature, pandemics and public health, social and racial division and tribalism, crippled government and endangered democracy. We need a winning system that can respond to those crises. Steve Bannon has been very clear for years. People will rise up. A populist revolution is coming. And his question is, will it be an uprising of the left or the right? And I look forward to speaking with Nelson about what I consider an enormously costly lost opportunity, a massive waste of talent and timing that millions have paid for ever since. But first, in preparing for this conversation, I was reminded that Lichtenstein's longtime focus has been on labor in America. And there's no question that unions are having a resurgent and the country is better for it. So we will start by talking about that. Nelson Lichtenstein is professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of 12 books, including Walter Reuther, The Most Dangerous Man in Detroit, The Retail Revolution, How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business, State of the Unions, A Century of American Labor, and his latest, A Fabulous Failure, The Clinton Presidency and the Transformation of American Capitalism, co-authored with Judith Stein. Welcome, Nelson Lichtenstein, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Glad to be here.
Okay. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Thursday, November 2nd. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us, in your words, a bit about how you see your path to the work you do today, the life you're leading? Feel free to go way back. Childhood experiences, mentors, turning points.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm from kind of a smallish town in Maryland, where my one parent was a refugee from Nazi Germany. The other was a refugee from the Deep South. And I grew up in a liberal household, went to Dartmouth, and then went to Berkeley. And my politics and my sense of myself were formed in Berkeley, unquestionably. And that was very important. In fact, we will talk about the auto strike undoubtedly, but one of my most vivid memories at Berkeley, this will tell you how old I am, was on the night of September 14th, 1970, when the General Motors workers then, at Fremont, that was a plant General Motors had then, going out on strike. And we, a bunch of Berkeley grad students and radicals and whatnot, went down there to greet them as they, you know, went on strike. And so September 14th, I mean, this most recent strike also began at midnight on September 14th. So I was there 53 years ago when General Motors went out. I have been interested in labor things, but I have to say that I don't think you can sort of write about labor independent of anything else, really. I mean, I think I'd be, if I had my druthers, I'd abolish the phrase labor historian, labor history, because really you can't have one hand clapping. You've got to talk about politics and business and capitalism and trade and everything else. So that's the way I see it. It has to be in kind of in tandem with and in relationship to everything else that's going on. That's the reason I wrote the Clinton book, because I think that the Clinton and his people, they were interested in reforming some of the worst aspects of American capitalism. You're right. There was a lot of excitement when Clinton first came in. But, you know, they did not, they couldn't make history as they chose. They were confronted with the structure of capital and that, in those days, a very weak labor movement, by the way.
Yes.
A figure like Joe Biden, for example, who was there as senator, you know, in that period of the Clinton period. I and actually quite a centrist, if not even a conservative. Well, today, at least on the domestic side, he's done some things that are pretty bold. But it just shows that, you know, people, yes, he can change, but also the constellation of forces and opportunities that greet him in 1993. So, you know, in that respect, what I was trying to see is, okay, there's the man there and the people around him, and Hillary was important too. Okay, you know, what did they want to do? What were their ideas? And then where were they thwarted and where were they successful? And sometimes that was not dependent on what, you know, they could struggle and try, but much overwhelmed what they thought to do. And so I tried to piece that out in the book on a fabulous failure, which I wrote. But today, you're right, we are in this remarkable moment. This recent UAW strike just settled three days ago. At least they haven't ratified it, but it probably will be, is a remarkably big and progressive a victory on the part of labor. And a new figure has come on the national scene, Sean Fain, who, yeah, I think we'll hear a lot more about. I think we'll hear a lot more about him because he has, as I say, one thing to give a good speech, it's another thing to have, you know, thousands of workers standing behind you, you know. And I think that always gives to a labor leader or any kind of political leader, yeah, or anyone leading a mass movement, you know, it gives a sort of a weight to the speech, you know. It's, yes, not, you know, academics like me can sit and stand in front of a classroom, but Sean Fain does have some troops.
Well, let's jump into labor. I have broader questions, but let's stay with the UAW, which is sort of the headline of the moment.
Yeah.
One thing that that I've come across is that the election of Sean Fain couldn't have happened a few years ago. That the UAW changed their rules. I think when I read about the UPS. Not strike, but the UPS, yeah, action and settle and negotiation, that the Teamsters also had changed some of the ways they operated internally, which made it more possible for good things to happen. Can you talk about that in both those cases? Yeah.
Yeah. 30 odd years ago, the Teamsters have been known, they're all known, you know, for corruption of various sorts, and that's all true. And back in the late 80s now, the Teamsters were always caught up in various kinds of corruption. And at that time, a young and seemingly liberal district attorney in New York named Rudy Giuliani got on the case. And what the Democratic and progressive oppositionists inside the Teamsters, what they didn't want was for the government to put a monitor, you know, to kind of a babysitter on the union. What they really wanted was to democratize the internal life of the union, and that's what they did in having a series of votes for president. And they were monitored to make sure they were clean and not corrupt. And as a result of that, Ron Carey, a reformer, did become president of the Teamsters in the 1990s, a big one in 1997. Was under his leadership. Then he was defeated, and the Hoffa came. James Hoffa, kind of the stepson of the famous Hoffa, came in, and he ran the place for 20, 30 years. But yeah, there was always an opposition group in the Teamsters, and just recently they kind of joined forces with some people who were in the leadership of the Teamsters, but sort of broke with Hoffa. And so the guy who's now president, James O'Brien, is cooperating with the left, with the liberals, with the progressives, and speaking with them, hiring some of them on his staff. And I think they didn't have a strike on August 1st, but they did have a very vigorous and engaged campaign. It went on for months and months beforehand, and as a result, they got a very, very substantial victory. You know, in collective bargaining, in terms of wages, getting rid of part-time workers and things of that sort. So that was the Teamsters, a very big union.
Before you jump from that one to the UAW, one thing that I think is also noticeable and significant about both of these new contracts is it isn't just about wages and benefits. It's also about working conditions. that the pandemic seemed to have done something to people that said, wait a minute, we want to change the way we work. So in the UPS case, I'll hand it to you. Yeah, some of the changes in conditions.
Yeah, I mean, one thing they really wanted to do in the UPS case was to eliminate some of these sort of second class citizens. There are many. I mean, actually, more than half of all the people who work at UPS, especially those in the big distribution centers, are kind of second tier or temporary or lower wage workers. And they this is terrible for solidarity. You know, I always say this, that one of the things you hear, you know, all the time, we hear it all the time, and the union leaders say it too, is, oh, you know, the president of the company is making, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and we're not, and, you know, we're making less, and that's terrible inequality. That's absolutely the case. But very rarely does an ordinary worker meet, you know, the president of the company or see their, you know, flying off in their jet. What they do see every single day is the person standing next to them behind the counter, on the line, you know, whatever they're doing, who's making like $2 an hour more than they are, or $2 an hour less than they are, because they're in another category. And that's what really rankles, because you see it every day, and that can really destroy a union. So,
yeah, I can imagine, by the way, someone next to you can take the vacation you can't take.
Yeah,
someone next to you can send their kid to the school you can't send yours to.
Right, or has a better pension, or whatever it is. And so that, I mean, I think that people, you know, us, you know, in the kind of chattering classes, you know, we're less aware of that. That doesn't, you know, you can see how much they're making, the Elon Musks and whatnot.
Right.
What you can't see, it's hard to see, is the person right next to you doing the same job you are, earning $2 more, or three, or, you know, whatever. And that, and so the Teamsters were determined to do as much as they could to eliminate that. And so the contract the Teamsters got was extraordinarily progressive, meaning the lower wage workers got bigger wage increases percentage-wise, and in some cases dollar-wise, than the higher paid. Now, another thing, the economists talk about the Great Compression in the 1940s and 50s, wages are compressed. And again, we usually think, oh, the rich aren't making so much, they're being taxed, and, you know, people at the bottom. That's all true. But the less skilled workers in textiles, or workers even on the farm, were making more money, relatively speaking, and then you know, traditionally higher paid workers. So the difference between a textile worker and an auto worker in the 1950s shrank. And that's extraordinarily important. And that has a big racial and gender component to it. And so, you know, in the heyday of the UAW in the 50s, in Michigan, a African-American auto worker would be earning 95% as much as a white auto worker, you know, taken, you know, on average. And so that was extraordinarily important for like the civil rights movement and things of that sort. So anyway, that was true of the Teamsters contract. It was very progressive in that respect. And the same is true, by the way, of the auto contract.
That's right.
Again, the lower wage workers, the ones that are temps, the ones that are on second tier, they got huge wage increases like 100%, like right away. I mean, that's unheard of.
Yeah.
And I think that will have huge consequences when people get wind of that. What, my wages doubled, you know, because of a union? Well, that's a pretty powerful idea, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing, by the way, when I was also talking about that, the two-tier thing eliminated in both of those contracts is so important. And what many people probably don't remember is that some of that two-tier stuff was an accommodation to certainly in the auto workers' case, I'm not sure about UPS, after the crash when the government had to step in. And so the workers gave stuff up and they created this two-tier, and it was supposed to be temporary. Well, here we are 15 years later, and only now did it get taken care of. But the other thing I was even talking about, Nelson, was I think air-conditioned UPS trucks, actually make their lives, their daily working lives better.
That's right. One of the things they were to begin the air conditioning of all the trucks. That's right. No, you're right about that. But the other things too, like you know, having guaranteed brakes, you know, and you know, having you know. when you get called in to come to work, you know, they won't send you home in 2 hours. You know, you have to keep you 4 or 6, you know, there are things like that. There are all sorts of things often called work rules, which to people who aren't involved in that particular industry, it seems like, what the hell is that? Some bureaucratic right. thing. But what it means is making life, one of the things that has not been unionized and management resisting it is the whole retail, you know, fast food sector that includes Starbucks and Walmart and everything like that. And one of the reasons is wages. They don't want to pay high wages, but much more important to management is they want to be able to have this, what they would call flexibility. That is, yeah, come in on Tuesday for 4 hours and then come in on Thursday for 6 hours and then goodbye on Friday. Well, that's great for the business because you only pay people for exactly the hours that they're needed, but it wreaks havoc with the life of an individual who has childcare and other kind of, you know, things of that sort. So,
right. And if I'm not, let me jump in again. And if I'm not mistaken, it isn't just that it will change all the time. It's that you won't know ahead of time what's happening to you this week.
That's right. That's right. You know, I would just say, I wanted to just make 30 years ago, I mean, it wasn't as if in the era of the Clinton, some of these same issues that we have today were not there. They were things like, for example, you know, Japan, in those days, Japan seemed mm-hmm. to be the great industrial threat to today. China is. And so there were people in the Clinton administration, among them Robert Reich and others, Tyson, who was head of the Council of Economic Advisors, right. who wanted to have a kind of industrial policy, the kind of thing that not as big as or as bold as what Biden's done, but, you know, direct money to certain kinds of industries to revive them and that idea. But I mean, for a number of reasons, that, you know, that didn't work. And we can talk about that. But one of the other things they thought of, and this is now seems kind of almost quaint, and mm-hmm. Is this that, oh, if we have much more labor management cooperation, you know, in various, then we can increase productivity. And then wages will go up and everything will be better. And Robert Reich was a big advocate of that. Well, you know, when you listen to the speeches of a Sean Fain today or any other labor leader, that idea just seems completely, you know, because there was cooperation. We did have cooperation, but what was the result of it? The result of it was lower wages and worse conditions. And, you know, the management was not willing to tango on that. They weren't willing to cooperate, really.
Right, so if only one side is cooperating, that's not cooperation. Yeah,
right. That's right. And I mean, and actually, just to give you another kind of very stark example, here we've had this very successful strike with a great sense of solidarity and momentum. In the 1990s, what was the big strike in the kind of UAW auto, well, and agricultural equipment? It was against Caterpillar, and it was a brutal multi-year losing strike that just was horrible. And they called Central Illinois the war zone, and there were scabs who went back to who crossed the picket line, and there was a company that was outsourcing stuff to New Mexico and etc. I mean, it was a brutal class war, and the administration just sort of checked out on that question. Biden shows up on the picket line of the UAW. Well, Bill Clinton, as president, did not show up on the picket line of the Caterpillar workers when they were in desperate shape. And from his point of view, for good reason. Why should I get myself involved in a that seems to be losing? That's not a smart way to get reelected. So, I mean, which is, by the way most politicians see things when it comes to industrial conflict. And so Biden's showing up for 15 minutes symbolically was kind of bold and was a break from the usual tradition.
Right, and in some sense, slightly risky. In other words, you are taking one side.
That's right. And here, I mean, here the this strike of the UAW was actually fundamentally a political strike in the following fashion.
Oh, thank you.
Let me tell you why. So Biden and the administration has put up, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act, so-called, to basically, you know, build, you know, have an electric vehicle transition. And, you know, and okay, that's industrial policy. That means you're directing, you know, investment directly in an industry that you, you know, take a look at, and you think that's the future. Now, you know, and of course it has an environmental aspect to it, the green, you know, a green transition, mm-hmm. so-called. Mm-hmm. Now, the Republicans, the conservatives have said, this will fail. They basically say this will, the new jobs, if there are new jobs created in electrical, there'll be terrible jobs, there'll be lower wage jobs, or they won't exist at all. China will just have them. So Republicans say, it's going to fail. Don't do it. Don't support Biden on this. The UAW was saying, yes, it's going to work, and we're going to make sure it does work. And there, and one of the main demands was to make sure that the new battery plants, they're going to be built all over the country, and especially in the South, are under the master contract, which they just negotiated with high wages. So when Biden shows up on the picket line, what he's saying is, I want you to win because I want you, your winning will be me winning in terms of the green transition. And then Donald Trump the next day shows up at a non-union supplier in Detroit and basically says, no, it's going to fail. And the UAW is going to fail. And I mean, so that was what it, that was what made this a very political and partisan strike, for that matter.
Yeah, and the other thing I was going to say is that in terms of risk is that what we saw as this is me taking a little historical perspective. What we saw with the Democratic Party was that as unions weakened and as campaigns got more expensive, the Democrats started calling on Wall Street the same way the Republicans were.
Right.
And the analogy or the metaphor that I use, Nelson, is that the Republicans are absolutely aligned with their Wall Street funders. Absolutely. So they are going for touchdowns. The Democrats say they are aligned with labor while they're taking money from Wall Street. And so they go for field goals. And you touchdowns win.
Yeah. Well, here I would like to talk about a figure from the Clinton administration, Robert Rubin, who was Goldman Sachs. And let me say something, a few words about him. So, not all of Wall Street is partisan. So Robert Rubin, and actually Goldman Sachs for that matter, which is a very big
investment. That's what I was saying, actually, is that they are beholding to the ones who side with them. Go ahead.
Yeah. They were, I mean, Rubin was a cosmopolitan figure, a Democrat. He actually supported George McGovern and raised money for George McGovern in 1972. His mother worked for Henry Wallace.
Oh, my.
Rubin was a racial liberal. He was in favor of various, you know, obviously, you know, affirmative action and et cetera, et cetera. And he was actually against the Clinton's infamous welfare reform bill, which, you know, to reduce the scope of welfare for especially for single mothers on the ground, said Robert Rubin, capitalism is unstable. Some people are going to end up being losers despite, you know, whatever their best intentions. So we need a social safety net. Now, I say all that to indicate why he was a kind of an attractive figure to a lot of actual liberals in those days, including Clinton. However, Rubin's kind of most important core values were the mobility of capital was absolutely essential, and he was militantly hostile to any kind of industrial policy. He thought the market, if it's not corrupt, if it's given the right guidelines, will be the most efficient way to spread wealth everywhere, both abroad and at home. And their view of Rubin would say, you want to invest in America? Look, Robert Reich might have a program for $50 billion or $100 billion of direct investment. Okay, fine. We have no budget deficit. If the bond market's happy, if the interest rates come down, we'll have $1 trillion worth of new investment, in the 1990s. Now, that a new investment would not be guided in any way. It would there would be no, you know, it could go into stock buybacks, it could go into yes, yachts, it could
yes,
go
that was going to be the, by the way, Nelson, that was going to be the first thing I was going to say. Buybacks, go ahead.
So what I mean is that Rubin saw the efficient open liquid markets as the absolutely crucial. He might have had liberal social values, but right. more important than that was yeah. and then you see that repeatedly kind of clashing, as it were, throughout the Clinton era. And of course Rubin, in this period of globalization, in this period when trade and new technologies were seen as the kind of the savior, really, in a way, of American capitalism, the Rubens and the Larry Summers and the people of that sort, they won the battle. They won an internal battle, which was dividing the Clinton administration in various yes. moments. And they won.
Yeah. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Nelson Lichtenstein, history professor at UC Santa Barbara. And the occasion of this conversation is the publication of his book, co-authored with Judith Stein, A Fabulous Failure, The Clinton Presidency and the Transformation of American Capitalism. But here we are at the halfway mark. We have talked a lot about labor because he has a great background in labor, and it's a big issue these days. And to learn more about his work, you can go to press, or about the book, go to press.princeton.edu, and you can search for either Fabulous Failure or Nelson Lichtenstein. So yeah, I remember one thing was that Reich was big, as you mentioned, into corporate responsibility. This is that theme of cooperation. And and Rubin did not like the phrase corporate responsibility. He found it inflammatory, class warfare.
I'll tell you the story on that. So Robert Reich, today, by the way, Robert Reich is more lefty than he was in the Clinton era. But then, anyway, he was even with his more moderate politics then. And at one point in, I think, 1995, after actually Newt Gingrich and the Republicans had taken over Congress, so he knew that the Clinton administration couldn't do anything very much directly in terms of making unionism easier or things of that sort. He said, well, look, Bill Clinton is talking about personal responsibility, right? For, people, on welfare. Right. He's talking about the responsibility, of young, African-American males, to yep. have a family, that kind of thing. Al Gore was doing that too, by the way. Reich said, this was a period right after a number of massive layoffs. AT&T laid off 50,000 workers, and Chainsaw, what's the name? Dunlop laid off workers at various companies he bought over, and so Reich said, well, let's talk about corporate responsibility. Yeah. And let's work up some guidelines for what a good corporation should do. There was no law involved, but let's jawbone this, and maybe we'll have a meeting. And here's a kind of set of, don't lay off people if you can't help it, and provide health insurance and that sort of thing. Well, Rubin, he thought that sounded like class warfare. And I think, by the way, one reason was this was the period right after South Africa. There'd been the idea of corporate responsibility had been applied to companies in South Africa under apartheid, and that meant basically disinvest from South Africa. And while Rubin was again against apartheid, he didn't want to limit what capital could do around the globe. So he thought that Robert Reich's concept of corporate responsibility was kind of class language, And he said we can't use that. So eventually, the Clinton administration did have a conference, but they call it a corporate citizenship conference, right. Anyway, but yeah, that was just a kind of small little moment but nevertheless, it reflected the tenor of the times,
Absolutely. That's what it did. Absolutely. So let me see, we'll shift to focusing more on the Clinton book in just a second, but yeah. Let me ask you, given the, what I called resurgence of labor, I'd love to just get a couple of more of your views on that. Like, what explains, for you, the resurgence, both in the willingness to take stands, the ability to win, all of that. Why is that happening now?
Well, you know, I mean, there's some obvious things that the labor economists will point to, like a tight labor market, you know, low unemployment, for sure, you know, a kind of a little bit of rhetorical encouragement from the president. But I think that something else is going on. One is that the pandemic has had a long-term, long-range impact. What it, mainly delegitimizing the authority and the moral authority of management, whether they were good or bad, because the pandemic meant that, you know, people were going to work, or, you know, being, you know, whether, you know, especially those who are blue collar workers,
right?
And whether the manager was you know, obeying all the rules or not, you know, it didn't matter. They couldn't protect the health or the income stream, you know, or the future of tens of millions of workers. And I think this had the effect of planting this seed in the consciousness of tens of millions of people, whether they're non-union, union, didn't matter. Matt, you can't, you know, rely on management to take care of you. I think that's fundamental. That'll last for a generation.
What's interesting to me is that it seems to me that's like an individual dawning in someone's mind. Do you know what I mean? It's not like some big slogan or some big movement at first. It's just this guy thinks it and this woman thinks it.
Right. And then, of course, that, I mean, so that's part of it. And then, of course, also the presence of Bernie and Trump, for that matter. I mean, Trump is, you know, Trump says, you know, foreign trade, you know, that's not the end all and be all of everything, you know. And then, of course, Bernie is saying, you know, in terms of denouncing the billionaire class. And so I think that also is added to it. And I think that, so that's created, a series of coincidences or whatever you want to call it. But at this particular moment, we do have a heightened sense of grievance and momentum. Now, the danger is this, despite all of that, and, you know, despite the fact that big wage increases, which I think will be coming through, I just this morning, Toyota, non-union Toyota, is raising wages to basically mimic the agreement in Detroit. As a result of that, if you don't form new unions in like Silicon Valley or in Toyota and Nissan and Tesla in Starbucks, if you don't do that, management's strategy is we'll just wait. We'll just wait this out. Mm-hmm. You know, there'll be a recession sometime. You know, inflation will erode the way we've given our workers. And so let's just wait it out. And so that's why you need institutions of the working class, because they have, you know, they're there all the time, and they you know, they can look at the statistics, and they can come back in 2 or 3 years and say, we want more money. And at Toyota, that's not taking place, and that's an issue. In previous eras of working class popularity of unions, the 30s, the 60s, when it comes to public sector, you got big increases in the size of unions and in new unions. Well, we haven't got that yet today. All of these unions you're reading about in the paper on strike, they're either 80 or 120 years old.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. The Screenwriters Guild, wherever they, 1930s, they were formed. They're 90 years old. Yeah. The Teamsters formed in 1907. You know, I mean, so where the Starbucks, but they haven't got a contract.
For a second jump in so that people understand that. Starbucks, that first contract in Buffalo was 22 months ago, 23 months ago, right?
It wasn't almost a contract, 2 years.
Not a contract. The recognition of the union. I'm sorry. Right. See, a slip, because I assume, right? The recognition of the union was almost 2 years ago, and Starbucks has not offered them a contract yet. And I think you say something like, 260 or 360 unions now exist, and none of them have been offered a contract. So that was my next question. What is the solution to that, and where does the NLRB fit in?
Yes. Well, the NLRB, unfortunately, although very liberal today, is quite toothless. Quite toothless. Doesn't have really good remedies for a company just delaying and stalling. And the okay, so right, so that's and then new labor legislation is stuck in Congress. It's not going to pass. Once. That I mean, and actually, this is what the Wagner Act said. Why do we have the Wagner Act 1935? We want to avoid, riots in the street, basically. And so, I think I am advocating a kind of unruly, the civil rights style of organizing, where you have a mass arrest and whatnot, when it comes to the Teslas and Starbucks and Walmarts and the more elite side. One way to give the NLRB a club is for the Federal Trade Commission, which is now led by very liberal Lina Khan and others, to say we view anti-unionism and breaking the law as a violation of the antitrust statutes. And there's some argument that that's true. And therefore, the FTC does have a club. They have a very big club. They can stop, these multi-billion dollar mergers. And I think that there's a kind of communication and this and conversation going on between the NLRB and the FTC and the antitrust division of the Justice Department to say, what can we do, to get back to the original idea of antitrust in the 1890s. It wasn't just to lower prices for consumers. It was to challenge the concentration of corporate power. That's what it was all about. And certainly the Teslas and the Amazons and the et cetera today are concentrations of corporate power. So that's not going to happen tomorrow, but that's one way to give the NLRB a club.
The one thing I was going to say that I just want anyone who didn't hear the Greenhouse conversation a few weeks ago is that the polling on support of labor unions is the highest it's been in ever among young people. And I just think that bodes well. It helps if the NLRB has a club, but the popularity of unions and this kind of there's a feedback loop here. Their success breeds that I'm not a fool to be in favor of them. They actually work and so on. And one of the things that I think it was Starbucks, yes. The workers at Starbucks, one of the things they wanted was to be able to put tips on credit cards because it increased, I've heard it'll increase a barista's pay by about $5 an hour. And what Starbucks did was they gave it to all but the union organized
Right.
Starbucks. That kind of stuff, it seems to me, there's got to be a way to stop that. Let's move to Clinton.
Yeah.
I have read reviews of A Fabulous Failure. Some say you're too easy on Clinton, some say you're too hard. What is your sense of
Yeah.
the purpose of the book? The
Yeah.
you go.
Yeah, Clinton coming out of Arkansas, what did he want to do in Arkansas? He wanted to economically develop this very poor state. And Clinton was in, way back in the 60s, well, the 70s really, and 80s, he was in touch with all sorts of coming out of the New Left, Ira Magaziner, who had ideas about, reinventing American industry and others. And he was that's where he came from. He kind of the not the extreme left, but the kind of liberal.
A little to the
Came
left of the
into
DLC,
the House.
a little to the left of the DLC, which he was
Right. No,
identified
yes. And I make the point that this Democratic Leadership Council, which is often, seen it, and right, I mean, rightly so, a very conservative and really kind of almost Republican kind of
Right.
element in Democratic. I mean, he used them as much as they used him. That's what I'm saying. And it's a mistake to say that Clinton is simply a creature of the DLC. That is not true at the beginning, certainly in the beginning of his administration. So Clinton comes into office, has a lot of these ideas. Now, what I show in the book is the way in which the ideas that he had Some of them were, you know, he put into effect. He did raise taxes on the rich, for example. He did increase the earned income tax credit, you know, for poor people. I mean, he raised the minimum wage too. There were some things that he did do. But there were some of the big things were either failures or that he abandoned them. Like, for example, health reform, that was a big effort that they tried to put forward. And then later on, Clinton would in fact put forward, he would deregulate finance in a very big way. And so the point of that is not to show Clinton's personal moral failures or, you know, that sort of thing, although that was there. But it was to show that for reformers, and this is why it applies to today as much as then, reformers, it's not enough to have good ideas, you know, you have to have the troops behind you. You have to understand the political moment. You have to arrange your coalitions in the right way. And in order to, you know, go for success, and reformers can't, you know, just having the right position paper isn't going to do it. Clinton had many good position papers. And I think one of the things I show is that Clinton repeatedly divided the Democratic Party, largely on trade issues, for reasons that he just did not have to do. NAFTA would be the key. NAFTA was not his idea. It was idea of George H.W. Bush. But I mean, for a variety of, I think, reasons that he thought, oh, I've got to have some sort of bipartisan bill just to show, you know, we can do that. Anyway, and the net effect was to divide the Democrats. And he repeatedly did that. And so all of Clinton's good ideas would fall into a vacuum because he didn't have the troops behind him. And then, of course, that's just the partisan side of it. Then, of course, the structure of American capitalism. And I make this point in the book, and I made it actually in other places too. We think of big companies, certainly back in those days, before Silicon Valley really got rolling. Oh, what are the big companies? General Motors, you know, U.S. Steel, you know, they've been around for decades and decades. Well, this is a period of tremendous transition, and the Walmarts and the Pizza Huts, you know, and the and then Silicon Valley were coming to the fore. And I think Clinton, you know, you think of Clinton as a kind of, you know, and Al Gore is, you know, connected to Silicon Valley, but in fact they didn't quite understand the transformations that were taking place in American capitalism. And I think some of the failure both of their health insurance bill and also some of their trade ideas, I think it was because they didn't really fully grasp these changes that were taking place.
Let me jump in quickly. Did anybody really, right? In other words, the fact that they didn't grasp new economy was going to play out.
Yeah, within the administration, actually, Joseph Stiglitz, for example, was one figure who understood what was going on. Another was Fox Bourne. People haven't heard of her much, but she was head of the Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, and she waged a lone battle against deregulation of derivatives, and she lost decisively. Years later, you know, we had the 2008-2009 collapse, and the Rubens of the world, and Bill Clinton said, we made a big mistake. They admitted it. We made a big mistake in 98 and 99 in deregulating these derivatives, which were explosive. There were debates that went on inside the administration, and of course outside there were critics as well. And that's what I think I try to make the book interesting. It's not just, you know, he walks in the door as a kind of neoliberal or a kind of creature of the DLC or a kind of, you know, cheerleader for markets, but they end up being that way.
Yeah, and let me ask you about this. In one review of the book, someone says, the one who says you're too tough on him, he says that the Clinton administration's economic and environmental records are the best of any presidency in the past 50 years.
Yeah.
GDP improved. First time ownership increased. High school dropout rate diminished. Wages. Yeah. All these things. Teenage pregnancy dropped. Unemployment fell. So a lot of good stuff was happening. Why didn't that last? Or why didn't that matter? Yeah. If you kind of get, I mean, I'm not sure quite how to articulate it, but.
Yeah,
because I've always had this feeling, as I voiced in the introduction, that Bill let us down.
Yeah, Right. It's true. This is right. This is the I didn't know there were a lot of Clinton loyalists still around, but apparently there are. So they criticized me being too tough on Bill.
And Clinton. They're picking up your book. Right.
Yeah. The late 90s, it was low unemployment. That's right. Relatively low inflation, booming stock market. Real wages were rising for the lowest part of the working force. That's all true. And by the way, and Janet Yellen, now Treasury Secretary, and Alan Blinder, a very prominent economist, wrote a little book in the year 2000 called "A Fabulous Decade." You know,
in which they were,
and so my book is titled "A Fabulous Failure." Right. And okay, I do think this momentary prosperity was built on sand. It couldn't last. It was the crash of first 2001 and then 2008 was built into it. And one example of this is there are many. I mean, there was the finance was out of control, and it was gonna, you know, building pyramids of cards that were gonna collapse, and that was what the whole financial deregulation would subsequent to 2000.
It's almost as if you had an industrial policy that was about creating bubbles.
That's right. That's right. And the economists call it asset-based Keynesianism. That is, the government wasn't actually spending a lot of money, you know, in a Keynesian fashion, the way actually Biden is today. But the stock market's booming, so every homeowner and every, you know, person with a 401k, oh, this is great, terrific. Let's go out and buy another, you know, a car, because it's asset-based. And that's the fault of Alan Greenspan, who said, bubbles, I can never tell when a bubble comes, so let's just forget it, you know. And I have one little story I have to tell you about Alan Greenspan. So one reason that Alan Greenspan and others on the Fed thought they could keep interest rates relatively low, and that's what Rubin wanted, and that would mean that then you'd have a stock market boom, you know, because you could buy, etc. The one reason they thought that, one was, we have a new economy, all this Silicon Valley is really increasing productivity, and Greenspan was really into that, and that turned out to be, you know, semi-true, but not entirely true. Okay, the second reason, and more important, was this. Alan Greenspan thought American workers were, and this is his word, traumatized.
Right.
Yes, he thought as a result of PATCO, as a result of the layoffs, as a result of the recessions, American workers were fearful. Even when unemployment was low, they were fearful. And there was this incredible moment at the Fed in one of their meetings, right after the UPS strike of 1997, which was a big, they got a big wage increase, and they're having a debate, are American workers no longer traumatized? You know, and you know, oh, we—that's terrible. We want them to be fearful. We want them to be miserable. You know, and because then you can keep interest rates low. And Greenspan, they're talking, well, maybe we'll have to raise interest rates, because if workers all over the country are going to get wage increases, then we got to stop that. So it's sort of what Powell is doing today. So anyway, I thought that that conversation said a lot.
Yeah. So see if I can. Country. Yeah. See if I can put kind of because we got to end this conversation.
Sure.
I'll give you like a closing statement, and then that'll be the end of it. But kind of that what we're saying about Clinton is that yes, he let us down. But you're saying that it's partially because he had some illusions of what that new economy was going to be, and that his early defeats made him cautious, but that he just really didn't have the full game plan, as you say, of a labor movement and all of those sorts of things. So I'll give you a closing statement. You can link our whole conversation.
That's right. I mean, and the labor movement, for a variety of reasons, was particularly weak, not just in numbers, but in kind of ideas. It was just unpopular, very unpopular then.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today, I mean, there is I think that Biden sort of understands that, you know, okay, this labor movement, these are the troops that I need to. And you know, whether that translates into electoral terms or not, but it does it actually does in policy terms, because I think the UAW victory is a big boost for the green transition. Clinton didn't have that. I think the point of my book, A Fabulous Failure, everyone should go out and buy it, is that good ideas, you know, are not enough. good ideas are not enough. You need to have a kind of a social movement and a kind of coalition and a kind of understanding of who your enemy is and what and how to transcend that. So I think that's
this is good stuff. So folks, there's actually a lot of those earlier books by Nelson about labor probably are relevant right now. And you did a revision of State of the Union?
Well, yeah, an updating of it. Yeah, I mean, that is a kind of history of American labor in the 20th century, from the really era of Woodrow Wilson on. And yeah, I wrote it first in 2000, and then I revised it in the era, Obama era, and I have to revise it again. I mean, things keep changing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the point of that is that we've always had sort of the labor question. We thought, you know, which in the 19th century, you know, riots and strikes and violence and people being shot, that's the labor question, so-called. And we thought we solved that. We thought we solved that in the after the 30s, collective bargaining. That was the solution. But but clearly that's eroded. When only 6% of private sector workers are in a union, collective bargaining is not the solution to the problems of inequality and immiseration and everything of that sort. So the labor question has come roaring back as a racial and gendered and immigration, for that matter, component today, but it's still there.
Yeah. And then the new book is A Fabulous Failure, The Clinton Presidency and the Transformation of American Capitalism. As you can tell from this conversation, it's a little more nuanced than just Bill Clinton good, Bill Clinton bad. It's a real analysis of why his goals shifted and why things worked and things didn't. If you want to learn more about that book, you can go to press.princeton.edu and search for either Fabulous Failure or Liechtenstein. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcnally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and links to 10 or 15 articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site. You can also email me at temcnally@mac.com. And you can subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast at my site or at Apple Podcast and most podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at those sites. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. And thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Nelson Liechtenstein, and keep up your good work.
You're welcome. Thank you. Great to be on your show. Okay.